Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon will be a courthouse steps decision teleforum on the Supreme Court's June 22nd ruling in Lieu v. Securities and Exchange Commission. My name is Nick Marr, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Todd Bronstein, General Counsel International at Willis Towers Watson. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thanks for being with us today, Todd. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much, and thanks to the Federal Society for inviting me to do this teleforum. On Monday, the Supreme Court decided Lieu versus the Securities and Exchange Commission, an important case affecting the remedial powers of the Securities and Exchange Commission. In an 8-1 decision, the court held that the commission had statutory power to seek disgorgement of wrongdoers' profits in federal court, albeit in a less robust form than the commission had sought. The decision does represent at least a partial win for the commission. To be sure, all 9 justices rejected the commission's request that the Supreme Court affirm the lower court's broad disgorgement order. So the commission technically lost the proverbial battle. But it did pull out at least a partial victory in the larger war by having its authority to seek disgorgement affirmed when that outcome was by no means a foregone conclusion. However, the opinion raised almost as many questions as it answered, and it did this quite self-consciously. Courts and litigants could well spend years trying to piece together answers to some of these questions, as I'll talk about in more detail a bit later. But before doing that, let me give a bit of background on the issue and on the case. Disgorgement is a remedy under which a defendant is forced to give up his ill-gotten gains. For the SEC, it's been one of its most powerful tools, both in federal court and in the SEC's own administrative proceedings. Just by way of example, in fiscal year 2019, parties to commission enforcement proceedings, and these are both judicial proceedings and administrative proceedings, were ordered to pay a total of $3.25 billion in disgorgement, as compared to just $1.1 billion in civil penalties. But despite the widespread usage of disgorgement, there is no statute that expressly authorizes federal courts to order it in SEC enforcement actions. When disgorgement orders first began appearing in SEC enforcement actions some 50 years ago, the only remedy that the commission had expressed authority to seek from the courts was an injunction. And although there was no specific statutory basis for disgorgement, courts ordered disgorgement anyway, citing their inherent equity power to grant relief ancillary to injunctions. Over the years, Congress gradually expanded the remedies that the SEC was authorized by statute to seek in federal court. And in 2002, as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, Congress passed the language at issue here that the SEC relied on in seeking disgorgement. And that language states in pertinent part as follows, quote, "In any action or proceeding brought or instituted by the commission under any provision of the securities laws, any federal court may grant any equitable relief that may be appropriate or necessary for the benefit of investors," close quote. In the statute, Congress didn't define what qualified as equitable relief, and so there was an open question whether this language authorized disgorgement as the SEC had been seeking it in the preceding decades. 3 years ago, in 2017, in Kokesh versus SEC, the Supreme Court held that disgorgement, as the SEC had been seeking it, constitutes a penalty for purposes of a statute of limitations provision that governed enforcement of any, quote, civil fine, penalty, or forfeiture. In the Kokesh decision, Justice Sotomayor's opinion included a footnote stating that the court was expressing no opinion on the antecedent question of whether courts have authority to order disgorgement in the first place in SEC enforcement proceedings, or whether courts have properly applied disgorgement principles in SEC enforcement proceedings. And this footnote meant that a challenge to the SEC's disgorgement authority in federal court was inevitable. And that challenge came with the Lieu decision, which resolved the issue, at least in part. In writing for an 8-justice majority, Justice Sotomayor confirmed the language I quoted earlier, which authorizes the SEC to seek, quote, equitable relief in federal court, does encompass disgorgement, or at least it does so where the disgorgement does not exceed the defendant's net profits from an unlawful scheme and where the funds that the government collects are then awarded to victims. The opinion said that its methodology in interpreting this language was to determine whether the remedy was analyzing fell into one of the categories of relief that were typically available in equity historically. And the court surveyed works of equity jurisprudence, and it identified two principles that it said were key to deciding the case. The first principle is that in equity, courts are allowed to or authorized to strip wrongdoers of their ill-gotten gains. The second principle was that this remedy needed to be limited to an individual wrongdoer's net profits to be awarded to victims. Regarding the first principle about stripping wrongdoers of ill-gotten gains, the court observed that it's a foundational principle of equity that a wrongdoer should not profit from his own wrong. While the term disgorgement is a relatively recent vintage, the court did not find this to be particularly significant, given that the disgorgement remedy, the stripping wrongdoers of ill-gotten gains, had parallels to other remedies that were available historically. And the court pointed most notably to the remedy of accounting, which adhered to the same principles and was much more time-tested. Regarding the second principle, which is the limits on the remedy, the court observed that there were multiple such restrictions. The purpose of these was to avoid turning accounting or disgorgement or stripping the wrongdoer of ill-gotten gains into a punitive sanction, and a punitive sanction being something that equity does not count in it. So the court walked through some of those traditional limitations in equity. One limitation is that the remedy typically imposed a constructive trust on wrongful gains, so that the funds are held by the wrongdoer for the benefit of the wrong victim, as opposed to for the benefit of the public fisc or some other public interest. A second limitation is that the remedy was typically limited to net profits from wrongdoing. That is, the gains from any business or investment where both receipts and expenses are taken into account. Finally, historically, the remedy was generally awarded against individuals or against partners engaged in concerted wrongdoing, not against multiple wrongdoers on a joint and several liability theory. So after walking through these principles, the court rejected the position that the Liu case had been decided by Kokesh, which again said that the SEC's disgorgement effort amounted to a penalty for purposes of the statute of limitations. The court said that Kokesh evaluated, quote, a version of the SEC's disgorgement remedy that seemed to exceed the bounds of traditional equitable principles. But the court held that Kokesh had no bearing on the commission's ability to employ a more limited version of the remedy in the future, and that is what the court has now said the SEC may do. The court then remanded the case to the Ninth Circuit for further proceedings consistent with the opinion, and for future reference, both in the lower court in the Liu case and for other lower courts deciding future cases, it gave some limited guidance on the three ways in which it was restricting the SEC's disgorgement remedy. First, with regard to the requirement that funds be returned to victims, the court pointed to the language in the statute that the equitable relief that the commission is authorized to seek must be, quote, appropriate or necessary for the benefit of investors. The court said that this will, quote, generally require the SEC to return gains to wronged investors for their benefit. And I'll come back to talk a little bit more about this point in a few minutes. Second, on the joint and several liability point, the court said that joint and several liability is generally inappropriate. It can be acceptable, joint and several liability, that is, to impose on partners who are engaged in concerted wrongdoing. The court said that this is something that was done historically in equity. But as for other types of concerted wrongdoing, the court simply said that there's a wide range of relationships that could be an issue, from arm's length to much more close partnerships. And the court didn't see the need to delve further into whether joint and several liability might be available for particular kinds of relationships. Third, regarding the requirement that the courts should deduct legitimate expenses before ordering disgorgement, the court held or observed that there has historically been an exception in the situation where the entire profit results from wrongdoing. And in that situation, equity had denied defendants inequitable deductions, such as for personal services. Even when this exception applied, that is, even when courts are allowed to order defendants to disgorge something other than net profits, the courts are supposed to ascertain whether expenses are legitimate expenses or simply wrongful gains under another name. So that was the court's opinion. Justice Thomas filed a solo dissent. He would have held that even the limited form of disgorgement okayed by the majority was not authorized by the statute on the basis that it was not a recognized traditional form of equitable relief. Justice Thomas observed that there was no such thing as disgorgement available in the English Courts of Chancery, and that the term disgorgement was not even really used until the 1960s and 1970s. Justice Thomas observed that even today, it isn't clear what disgorgement means, and that this uncertainty was a concerning aspect of the court's opinion and made the future use of this remedy ripe for mischief. So having gone through this summary, let me make a few observations about the opinion and its implications for the future. The first observation is about the court's interpretive methodology. As I mentioned earlier, when disgorgement orders first appeared in SEC enforcement actions, half a century ago, there wasn't any specific statutory authorization for this. And instead, the courts relied on their inherent equity power to grant relief ancillary to remedies that had been authorized, which were injunctions. In this week's opinion, there was no hint of any sympathy to that line of thinking. That is, no hint of any sympathy for broad remedial powers untethered to any statutory grant. And that may not have been surprising given the last couple of decades of American jurisprudence, but it is worth emphasizing. Instead, Justice Sotomayor's opinion reflects really a careful reading of the statutory text. And since that statutory text used the phrase equitable relief, which is a term with a rich historical pedigree, the opinion carefully surveyed the history of how equitable relief was traditionally awarded. And one can disagree with how Justice Sotomayor chose to read the history, and that's what Justice Thomas did precisely in his dissent. But it's still notable that one of the more liberal justices, quote-unquote liberal justices, adopted this methodology. And I should add that the fact that she chose this methodology and had eight justices join it was not necessarily a foregone conclusion. It would have been fairly straightforward, actually, for Justice Sotomayor to have written an opinion saying that the statutory text here was intended to incorporate a more modern understanding of the SEC's disgorgement powers. In other words, that the statute had codified a range of lower court decisions adopting an expansive reading of the SEC's disgorgement powers that was not particularly tethered to traditional equitable remedies. And indeed, the government, in its briefing, developed this argument at great length. But the court specifically rejected this effort, choosing instead to look more broadly at the history of equitable relief. So my second observation about the opinion has to do with the court's treatment of the SEC. And to sort of maybe understate it just a little bit, the commission has had a real rough go of it in recent years when litigating cases at the Supreme Court about its remedial authorities. In 2013, in a case called Gabelli versus SEC, the court rejected the SEC's attempt in certain cases to toll the statute of limitations for seeking civil penalties. And the commission lost that case 9-0. I previously mentioned the Kokesh case, which was in 2017, where the court held that the commission was subject to a five-year statute of limitations when it sought disgorgement in federal court. And again, the commission lost that case 9-0 as well. In the Liu case, decided 2 days ago, the commission could also be said to have lost 9-0 as well, in the sense that all nine justices, including Justice Thomas, rejected the commission's efforts to affirm the lower court's broad disgorgement order. Now, this way of looking at the case is a bit unfair to the SEC as we think about Wu in the broader context of the Supreme Court's recent SEC jurisprudence. And I say that because going into this case, there was good reason to think that the disgorgement remedy wouldn't survive at all. For instance, in oral argument in Kokesh, several justices have been openly skeptical of whether disgorgement was proper. Just to give two examples, Chief Justice Roberts commented during the Kokesh oral argument that the SEC, quote, devised this remedy without any support from Congress. And Justice Gorsuch said of the disgorgement remedy, quote, there's no statute governing it. We're just making it up. And then, so not surprisingly, in the Liu case, the petitioner spent an enormous amount of energy trying to persuade the court that the disgorgement remedy shouldn't survive at all. So the fact that the commission emerges from Liu with a form of disgorgement remedy could be viewed as something of a win. They may have technically lost the battle, but they didn't lose the war. And it could be argued that they won the war because they really prevailed on the fundamental issue at the heart of the case. With all of that said, the commission really can't take a great deal of comfort from this 9-0 result. You know, it's a 9-0 result. There are new limitations on a remedy it has employed for decades. And some of the language used by the justices is also fairly critical of the commission. The majority opinion, I think could be seen as sort of lightly chastising the SEC. It noted that over the years, the SEC's disgorgement remedy had occasionally drifted from its statutory authorization and taken on features that were in, quote, considerable tension with equity practices. Justice Thomas, in dissent, was more pointed. He noted some of the doctrinal uncertainties that went unaddressed by the court's opinion, which I'll talk about in more detail in a second. And then he commented, quote, if passage prologue, this uncertainty is sure to create opportunities for the SEC to continue exercising unlawful power. So let me turn now to my third and probably my most important observation about the Liu opinion, which relates to the ramifications of this opinion for the courts, for the commission, and for the business community. The opinion left a number of questions unanswered, and it did this quite self-consciously. And as a result, courts and litigants may struggle to interpret and apply the guidance that's been given. To take the most notable example, the opinion stated that the disgorgement remedy, quote, generally requires the SEC to return a defendant's gains to wronged investors. And that's in contrast to the SEC's previous practice in many cases of simply depositing disgorged funds into the Treasury. In arguing its case before the court, the government had taken the position that merely depriving a wrongdoer of ill-gotten gains would satisfy the statutory test that equitable relief must be, quote, for the benefit of investors. But the court rejected this position and said, no, it's got to be something more than merely depriving the wrongdoer of ill-gotten gains. It's got to be something on top of that. So although the court said that generally you have to return language to the victim, the court did not squarely take the view that the commission must always return funds to victims. Used the general language, but didn't set out what the exceptions might be. And that leaves some uncertainty in how the commission and the courts and litigants should think about a couple of fairly common scenarios. One scenario is SEC enforcement actions where there is no identifiable class of victims. For instance, cases under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which the government itself, in oral argument, placed into the category of statutes without an identifiable class of victims. Some of the SEC's largest disgorgement settlements in recent years have been in the context of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases, and the amounts can reach into the, routinely go into the tens of millions of dollars and sometimes into the hundreds of millions of dollars. A second common scenario where there's now uncertainty is enforcement actions where there is a large class of victims and it is not practical to identify them or return funds to them. The court did pass on this issue, if only to say that it didn't see the need to address it to decide the case. It said that it is, quote, an open question whether and to what extent the practice of depositing disgorged funds to the Treasury would satisfy the statutory test when it's not feasible to return it to investors. And more generally, it declined to take a view on whether the feasibility of returning funds to investors is relevant to the application of equitable principles. So, going forward, it is just very unclear whether courts now have the ability to order disgorgement in Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases or cases involving large classes of victims where they can't be identified or where it's not feasible to return the funds. And given the amounts of money that are involved, this subject seems sure to be hotly contested in future litigation on this issue. And as I mentioned, you know, the questions about where the funds go was not the only unanswered question raised by this opinion. I mentioned that the disgorgement remedy, according to the court, should only take account of a defendant's profits. But again, the court acknowledged that there may be exceptions to this rule, for example, when the entire profit of a business results from wrongdoing. And in that case, the court is allowed to look at whether individual expenses are legitimate or not. And similarly, the court said that it was, quote, generally the rule that the disgorgement remedy should apply only to individuals or partners engaged in concerted wrongdoing, and that therefore joint and several liability is clearly the exception rather than the rule. But again, the court went on to observe that equity did permit some flexibility in imposing collective liability, including in the case of partners. And given the wide spectrum of potential relationships, the court didn't feel the need to pass on them, and therefore it can become a subject of uncertainty and future litigation. A final unanswered question from the Liu opinion is whether the limitations announced on the disgorgement remedy in federal court apply only in federal court or also when the commission seeks disgorgement in an administrative proceeding. The posture of today's case was, or rather this week's case, was federal court, but obviously the commission does have authority to seek disgorgement in administrative proceedings. And Justice Thomas raised the question in his dissent whether or not the limits announced in Liu apply in administrative proceedings, and the court just simply didn't answer it. The court in the Liu decision was interpreting a different statute than will apply to administrative proceedings. The statute governing judicial proceedings talks about equitable remedies, whereas the statute governing administrative proceedings does specifically talk about something called disgorgement. So in principle, it is possible for courts to treat the administrative remedy as being more expansive than the judicial remedy, but it's just not clear whether or not the court will go in that direction. So that's about all I have in terms of my prepared remarks about Liu versus SEC. With that, I'm certainly happy to take any questions you may have.
Great. Thanks, Todd. All right, let's go to audience questions. Let's see. And just to kick us off, Todd, I have a question of my own. How do you see this opinion affecting the SEC's overall enforcement efforts or going forward? You said there was, it's not exactly clear. There are a lot of questions left unanswered by the court. So,
Well, look, the decision definitely has an impact on the SEC's ability to pursue robust enforcement in federal court. It certainly trims the amounts the SEC can seek and therefore its ability to, to get some of these eye-popping settlement amounts we've seen in recent years. That having been said, I'm not sure the overall impact on the overall enforcement program is going to be that significant. It may depend on future developments, judicial developments. And in particular, I mean, we've obviously seen this trend in recent years where the SEC is bringing more enforcement actions administratively. And the SEC retains its authority to seek disgorgement administratively. For the time being, at least, that power remains unaffected. If the courts decide that the reasoning of the Liu decision applies to the administrative form of disgorgement as much as it does the judicial form of disgorgement, that could certainly have a very significant impact on the SEC's enforcement program. For the time being, though, it seems likely that it will only accelerate the trend of bringing more cases administratively so that the SEC can take advantage of what it will surely assert as being its more robust disgorgement remedy in its administrative proceedings.
I see. Great. All right. We'll go to the first question now.
Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick in D.C. I think I know the answer to this question, and it's probably stupid, but I'll ask it anyways. I assume this opinion has no application to any other federal statute unless the statute in its remedies section has the word disgorgement or something comparable to that. Is that correct?
So this statute actually, what's interesting about this is that it wasn't interpreting the word disgorgement. It was interpreting a grant of power that talked about equitable remedies for the benefit of investors. And so I think it is fair to say that where courts are construing other grants of power that may make reference to equitable remedies, it would have at a minimum persuasive effect on interpretive methodology. And in particular, the fact that all nine justices looked at, you know, went back to, you know, the English courts of chancery and how equitable practice was applied over the centuries. That is an interpretive choice they had made in previous cases, but they reaffirmed it here, and so it would have that effect in other contexts where Congress has talked about equitable remedies or equitable relief. Since the word disgorgement itself was not something that the courts construed, it may actually not have particular effect in situations where Congress used the word disgorgement. So I mentioned the FCC's administrative proceedings, where they did use the term disgorgement, and one can imagine that the commission will take the position that since Congress used the word disgorgement in that statute, it must mean something different from what the court talked about today. I would fully expect the FCC to take that position, and litigants, of course, will take the opposite position, or defendants will take the opposite position.
Todd, we'll go to the next question here.
Hi, my name is Robert Ephraimson. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I didn't actually have a question. I just wanted to compliment Mr. Brownstein on what I thought was a really excellent, clear presentation. I was very impressed with the way you explained the decision, something that isn't necessarily my area, but I thought you did a great job, and that's all I wanted to say. Just congratulations. That was really terrific. Thanks.
Thanks so much, and I'll give you your $10 after the call.
Thank you, caller. Todd, we don't have any pending questions at this moment. Do you have a... Oh, actually, we do have one. Here we go.
This is Bob Fitzpatrick again. I got muted when you were giving your answer, and it turns out I guess I'm dead wrong. So I'm an employment lawyer, and Title VII, for example, has, as I recall, some pretty strong language about equitable relief. Can I see plaintiff lawyers arguing for disgorgement of profits that are proximately caused by, for example, discriminatory conduct? Or is that just totally off the wall?
No, without looking at the specific statute, it's a little hard to comment. In the Lew decision, you know, the court talked about, you know, the statute at issue talked about equitable relief that is appropriate for the benefit of investors, and Justice Sotomayor's opinion took some pains to say that isn't the same thing as a freestanding grant of all equitable relief. She actually sort of made a point of saying we have to give effect to every word of the statute. And therefore, this language needs to mean something. There needs to be some kind of limitation on that. Now, I'm not familiar with notwithstanding all the discussion of Title VII over the last week or so, I actually don't know enough about Title VII to comment on the equitable relief bit. What I think probably is fair to say is that to the extent that Congress used that phrase, and to the extent that they haven't, you know, already, the court hasn't already interpreted what that language means, you know, the clear message from this opinion that all nine justices agreed on is that when you're looking at equitable relief, you look at what was available historically in the court of chancery and in equitable courts, you know, from the time of the founding forward. And that's the methodology you use. And so whether or not that would mean disgorgement in employment law cases, I'm not really sure, but at least, you know, that would be where you would start methodologically if you were writing on a blank slate, I think.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Sure.
All right, Todd, we don't have any questions pending right now.
Sure. I think, you know, the decision, you know, I was at oral argument for the decision. The decision was absolutely not a surprise given what the justices, given the thrust of the questioning at oral argument. It was clear that the justices were looking for a kind of middle ground in between what the maximalist position adopted by the SEC, where, you know, where disgorgement didn't necessarily include net profits and didn't have to go to victims, versus the position urged by the petitioners to eliminate the disgorgement remedy altogether. And so the position was not a surprise in that sense. It's got something for the commission to like in that it kept the remedy, and it's got something for the commission not to like, really very much a middle ground in that sense. So, but you know, I think really interesting opinion, and it'll be interesting to see how the interpretive questions I mentioned, you know, play out, you know, in the coming years.
Great. Thank you, Todd. Thanks so much for joining us. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.